Pakistan's civilian government could prompt the military to intervene. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Islamabad.
Ford Motor Company is reporting a sharp drop in earnings. The Detroit automaker says profits fell 57% in the second quarter. That's amid losses in Europe and Asia. Ford is lowering its forecast for the rest of the year. Toyota, meanwhile, says its sales are rebounding strongly. The automaker says it sold nearly 5 million new vehicles worldwide so far this year. Analysts say Toyota could soon regain the top perch in the automotive industry from General Motors. Japan is reporting its largest trade deficit on record. It totaled nearly $37.5 billion for the first half of the year. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, studying the impact of higher nutrition standards for snacks and beverages sold in schools at pewtrusts.org.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about cybersecurity. Now, this is something that certainly has been identified by people in government and by people in academe as being a serious issue. And in fact, the president, President Obama, had declared that the cyber threat was one of the most serious economic and national security challenges that we face as a nation. He said America's economic prosperity in the 21st century will depend on cybersecurity. At the same time, it seems that what for most people, for most citizens, what they're concerned about are issues of free access to the internet and issues of privacy. And certainly people in government are concerned about that, too. So in this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about perhaps how it's possible to craft a policy, or if it is possible to craft a policy that can address both of those concerns. That is, the privacy and access concerns and the security concerns. We'll talk a little bit about some legislation that has been up for discussion in Washington. And we're happy to have here as guest Jake Kazin. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. He's interested in things like patent law and intellectual property, cyber law, digital government. He also directs the program in intellectual property and technology law in the U of I College of Law. And he is regularly heard on this station. I'm sure if you're a regular listener, you know about the series, this long-run series of commentaries that we do called Legal Issues in the News. And he's been doing that for a very long time as well. Well, thanks very much for being here.
And thank you, David. Always fun to be here.
Well, it's been a long time. I know we have had you on the show before to talk about intellectual property issues,
indeed,
copyright and so forth. Still good current topics.
Indeed.
But this is one that also deserves some attention. And the quotes that I mentioned from the president, that wasn't just from last week. That was from several years ago. So
sure.
This is a longstanding concern. And not his alone. Previous administrations have certainly talked about it. And it is something that the government has responded to on various levels, including on the levels of the Department of Defense. So it's not that people aren't thinking about this.
Absolutely. As you move away from conventional warfare and people are sort of realizing that there is a whole new frontier where, you know, you can really inflict damage to people who you're not friends with or maybe enemies with. It opens up a whole new frontier.
Yeah.
And let's face it, things like utilities, transportation, communication, you know, this is what is the lifeblood of the American economy.
Yeah. And that is where I think the challenge, one of the challenges lies for the government, and that is that the infrastructure that we depend on, the communications infrastructure, utilities, the banking system, the things that really are going to be the targets of the threats are all controlled by private business. It's not, you know, the Pentagon can take care of itself, but this is something where the government has limited ability to involve itself in the way these businesses do business.
Yeah, this is often referred to as sort of the critical national infrastructure. Sort of you hear this word over and over again, CNI, in short. And really, all of the CNI, for the most part, you know, is, 95%+ is in private hands in our economy. And these are private owners, and they are necessarily motivated, you know, for to do things largely in response to, of course, their customers and their shareholders. And the concern is that, perhaps they may not be paying adequate attention to installing the kind of safeguards that are needed. Perhaps they may not even be aware of and not have access to classified information that really things that they ought to know that they are in fact being targeted, mm-hmm. for example. And so there's a whole slew of these issues where the government may know some things and then the private sector may know other things. But the government doesn't know how these companies run their operations. Mm-hmm. They're not experts in these industries. So you can see that there is a problem in the sense that they have access to different pieces of information.
Yeah. And there just is basic a question as well, what is the nature of the threat to this infrastructure is something that you'd think it would be important for government to know, but that for companies, for whatever reasons, they're not going to reveal everything that they're doing and everything they know. In fact, there is no requirement. I don't believe that there is any requirement for a private business to even tell the government that it was a victim of an attack.
And that's where some of the tensions come in. If you're running a utility, you don't want to make your customers nervous by telling them about, your vulnerabilities. On the other hand, you want to sort of, if you've been attacked, you really do want to know who are these people and, what exactly are your exposures, what exactly is the threat. And some of this information, the government may be able to help them with that. Of course, there's private companies also now that are getting into this game and that are offering these services. Mm-hmm. So you can see how simply going to the government and telling them, oh, my God, I've been attacked, is not something that is necessarily in their best interest to do so. The current versions of the bills that are in Congress, most of them say, hey, you don't have to mandatorily disclose, but a couple of them do say that if you're an operator of a CNI, and then there should be mandatory disclosure. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of versions there that are being considered, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we could talk specifically about some legislation here, and one that if people follow this area, they certainly will be aware of, something called the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. This is something that was passed by the House. And that then has gone over to the Senate. Now, we can talk in a moment maybe about what's happening in the Senate, because there we have two competing visions that are different. But this thing, it often referred to as CISPA by the initials, Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. What is it all about?
Well, there's the House version does several things. It tries to sort of say, hey, we need to come up with some schemes to protect critical national infrastructure. It deals with things like information sharing by the private sector and to the government and from the government to the private sector. So the idea here is to have some sort of partnership where comfortably information can be disclosed. And there are some protections in CISPA for, personal privacy, that you can't the personal information cannot be part of a FOIA request. It cannot be used for any kind of regulatory, issues or regulatory purposes. And there are certain things like tax records and financial records and, gun sale records and so on. And book sales and those kinds of records that you simply cannot disclose. And so there's protection for those. And there is also civil actions for you can, you know, in case there's a violation, you can actually sue and, you know, collect, you know, hopefully, possibly for money damages if violations occur. And then there is also a third piece, which is sort of ratcheting up of the penalties, trying to basically make increase the amount of sentences for various cyber crimes. And these are amendments of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA. And then there is also provisions for things like making certain criminal violations a predicate offense under RICO, the Federal Organized Crime Act. So then that sort of, again, ratchets up the penalties some more. Mm-hmm. So that's there's a whole sort of slew of things in there under CISPA that's passed by the House, as you just mentioned.
So just on one point, now does the House version of this, does this require private business to disclose to the government when it has been the victim of a cyber attack?
It's not required.
Not required. Okay. And the protections, now this, as you say, the thing that I think a lot of people are very concerned about with this legislation is what sort of protections there are for individuals of their personal information. And the concern is that businesses have a wide range of information about us, and we would rather not that they pass that on to the government. Do you think that the protections here for that are adequate?
Well, sort of remains to be seen. But the initial version actually defined a cyber threat very broadly. Mm-hmm. And it just included just about anything. And so then they backed off from that. And now cyber threat is sort of much more directed to computer security violations. They're much more directed to sort of unauthorized intrusion, much more directed to trying to steal information or take information from you that's stored on a computer that you don't have access to, and sort of very classical things that there's, you know, probably not much debate about how this cyber threat is now defined, which is more narrow. But I think there is a concern that whenever information is given to the government, there's always the possibility that it is being given for one purpose and it eventually gets used for another purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, there are amendments here that are very specific that say, hey, you can use it only for these sort of five things. You can use it for cybersecurity. You can use it for national security. You can use it to prosecute cyber crimes. You can use it to prevent child pornography. And you can use it in situations where you're trying to prevent death or bodily harm. So really, those are really the categories. You really can't use it for other things. But the concern always is there. Now, there are protections. And so I think, you know, you sort of have to do the best you can and then see how these things evolve. But it is true that, you know, there is a lot of nervousness.
Let me introduce again our guest with this hour focus, if you might have just tuned in. Jay Kaysen is professor of law at the University of Illinois. He's interested in cyber law. That's one of the things that he is interested in. He's also director of the program in intellectual property and technology law at the College of Law. And questions are welcome here. We're talking about cybersecurity and some of the recent legislation that has been up for discussion on Capitol Hill to deal with the issue. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, and that's the address to use is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, this legislation that we're talking about, have talked about a little bit here, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. This was passed by the House, and it has gone over to the Senate. Now, on the Senate side, they're having an argument because there are essentially two competing responses. One is there's a group of senators who are backing it that includes the majority leader, Senator Reid, and also Joe Lieberman. He's the guy whose name is most often attached to that. And then there is also another proposal that's backed by some other senators, and there it seems that the guy in the lead is John McCain. So those are the two names that get attached to these two different approaches. And I do believe that they even call it something different. They don't call it CISPA. They call it something else. So what essentially is the Senate response here, and how do the two approaches differ?
Well, you can think about it as sort of, simply speaking, a sort of maximalist role for the government and a minimalist role for the government, sort of just simply put. The argument on one side is, hey, the government has a lot of information and knows a lot of things about, you know, cyber threats. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the National Security Agency, in the Department of Homeland Security, et cetera, that are monitoring a lot of these things. They've also developed a lot of tools to protect themselves. And so there's really a lot of core competencies here and that really, you know, they know how to do this whole security business. And it's something that they should be involved in. And they should be setting standards that the industry should comply with, and that's sort of at least the simple sort of baseline protection that should be out there, at least for critical national infrastructure. That's one argument. The other argument is that, well, you don't really know what all of these people are doing. You don't know how a utility is run. You don't know how a railroad is run. You don't know all these things. And you're simply using this as an excuse to impose a lot of regulations. And there is really, in fact, not even one example of where there has been any kind of mass attack. So this is sort of, you know, all this is sort of, hey, you know, preemptively you're trying to do all these things. And it's just another way of imposing regulations on the private sector, imposing costs on the private sector. And this is really a very bad time to do all these things. So you have Senator McCain on one side, and then, as you mentioned, you have Senator Reid and Lieberman on the other side. And that's sort of, I realize that I'm trying to simplify things here, but it really is the crux of the debate.
So it comes down to, again, this philosophical and political discussion about what's the appropriate level of regulation of industry. Is it, do you want more or do you want less?
Yes, and except that here you're dealing with a somewhat unique issue. Mm-hmm. Because in one sense, having good infrastructure is seen as something that government should do. You know, having good infrastructure that benefits the entire economy. And because no one player can do all that, and so you sort of, hey, so if the government is going to make these private sector do these things and so on, there's got to be some role, and perhaps maybe the government should help defer some of these expenses that these people have to undertake, and is there some tax subsidies or something else that can be offered to try to really boost up the amount of security, that is especially for, you know, critical things.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit earlier about this question of should there be a requirement that says to private business, say, if you've been a victim of a cyber attack, we, the government, need to know.
Right.
You need to tell us. And I think that in this particular case in the Senate, one of these includes that provision, the other one does not.
Yes. Absolutely. That is definitely something that the Senate is interested in one mm-hmm. version of it. I'm sure there's going to be a compromise. Some people feel that the compromise should be when it comes to critical national infrastructure. In other words, every business doesn't need to disclose every time there's a vulnerability. But if you're going to engage in business that is related to critical national infrastructure, then perhaps that's where the balance tips over. And perhaps that's where you need to tell people. Because it's not just about your business. It's really about, you know, if you've probably not installed this, and if you've been the subject of an attack, then perhaps it's soon going to be the case that others in your industry might be victims. We have information to tell you about the 15, 12, 20 groups, nasty groups that are out there. We know their fingerprints. We know their patterns. So we'll share information with you. So if you tell us that you've been attacked, then that becomes the basis for a public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So we really can actually come out ahead.
Yeah, and I believe that the business community generally has they're lining up with behind the guys who are saying less regulation is better.
Actually, yes, they are. But their ultimate hope is that, hey, it doesn't do them any good if they're attacked and they're, you know. So I think the ultimate hope really is, hey, can we work out a system so that, you know, perhaps we can agree on what sort of safeguards to put in place, and perhaps we can get some help from the government to do that. Perhaps you give us some sort of break to, you know, so that it's really in our best interest to sort of, you know, install these things and so on. But I think that this is a situation where both sides do realize that they have different sets of information, both of which are valuable. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real benefit to information sharing. And you know, it really wouldn't be good to have these sort of pieces of information be siloed. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of, you know, good people on both sides of the aisle who see the importance of that.
Yeah. Well, do you think, so here we have a situation where we have something, that the House has passed something, the Senate will need to pass something, so, and there is a debate about what it is they're going to pass. Then, of course, then once the Senate has passed something, then the House and the Senate are each going to have to look at what they've passed and try to figure out is some way that they can get together on something. So this is a very long process. Is it likely, do you think, that such a something will be worked out before the election, or is this something where that may indeed be pushed off into the next Congress?
I mean, odds are that, you know, it may not get worked out. But it is a very important issue. And there are a large number of bills. And these bills are not just about these things. There's other some Senate bills like the Secure IT Act that go beyond some of these things that say, hey, you know, let's allow the private sector to engage in some type of self-defense. You know, let's allow the private sector for the purposes of protecting their IT investments and their critical information. Let's allow them to do certain active things, you know, which might otherwise be seen as being problematic. And so it's part of another version of the another bill in the Senate that's been introduced called the Secure IT Act, as I just mentioned. So, in fact, the Senate bills are trying to address this very comprehensively. CISPA has sort of taken sort of, hey, let's come up with something that we feel is sort of a core that most people can agree to. And the Senate has sort of blown that whole thing up. And now the Senate bill has sort of got a whole bunch of different provisions, much more comprehensive, but much harder to sort of get a consensus around. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think it's going to happen, you know, in the next 6 months. Yeah. But I think that this is a debate that's not going to go away. And the 113th Congress is going to come and really address this, and there's almost no doubt about that. Yeah.
Well, and as I mentioned in the beginning, this is something that people have been talking about for a number of years now. The fact that it is that there is this threat, and that government needs to be prepared to respond, because there are other nations that might use this as an avenue of warfare, and so it is certainly something that the Pentagon has thought about and is prepared to respond to. But then this is another level when we're talking about, again, we're talking about infrastructure that's controlled by private business. You know, how are we going to deal with that? But given the fact that for a long time people have been saying, well, this is really important, we need to pay attention to it, what could you say about where we now are with this issue? Do you think at this point, given that it has been a long time that people have been talking about this being important, should we have a better policy in place by now?
Right. There's sort of two big things. One is, in fact, the private sector is doing what it can. And they're saying, hey, you know, we want to protect our critical infrastructure, and we want to definitely continue to do whatever business we're doing. And so they are seeking the help of other computer security experts and other private companies that are emerging, that are basically telling them not only what to do to improve their security and to avoid sort of, you know, going beyond, you know, infirmities in the software and malware that somebody might take advantage of. Going beyond that and saying, hey, we know the characteristics of how these different groups operate. And we've been tracking them. And we can tell you if you've been a victim of this group or the other group. And so they have these long-term services they're providing to other private sector companies. So one set of companies providing these services to another set of companies. You know, there's things like CrowdStrike and Mandiant, and just to name a few of these companies that are doing these things. And so you certainly have that going on. I mean, you know, sort of, hey, the market is finding its own solutions kind of thing. You know, and the other thing is that it's just not enough to have deterrence by simply ratcheting up penalties. And I think there's a greater realization of that. You know, you're not going to be able to deter cybercrime by just imposing longer sentences. First, there is no guarantee you're ever going to be able to get any kind of jurisdiction over these people. You're going to be ever going to be able to get a hold of them. You actually can, you know, prosecute anything. I mean, so this is sort of the whole civil and criminal liability issue. I mean, it's very infirm. I mean, this is sort of, this works if you're dealing with somebody who's, you know, intruding into your house. but deterrence by higher penalties is sort of, that's an area that basically people are realizing is sort of, you know, it's soon going to run out of steam. So we got to think about other ways of deterring. And so we have to think about deterrence by denial. So we have to think about deterrence by employing passive measures, for sure, and active measures. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to sort of get better trace route, trace back technologies, try and understand where these people are coming from. Now, all that is improving. And so we can actually then, of course, take passive measures. That's certainly not a problem, but we really want to do more. And we actually want to sort of do the equivalent of if somebody intrudes into your house, then they get tossed down a chute and thrown out into the front yard. You know, sort of, you know.
I think you're enjoying that image a little too much. We're talking this morning, this hour, with Jay Kazin. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. He's director of the program in intellectual property and technology law. We're talking about cybersecurity. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
It's hard to be in two places at once, but our reporters are in hundreds of places right now.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in Accra.
I'm Matthew Bell in the Golan Heights.
I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Paris.
Morocco.
Cairo.
In Mexico City.
Join us here at The World.
Monday through Friday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Birch Tree Counseling and Consulting, Champaign; Common Ground Food Co-op, Urbana; Prairie Boat Works Gallery, Champaign; and Lowell Heap Farm, Dewey. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Jay Kazin. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. He is interested in a number of things, including patent law, intellectual property, cyber law, digital government. He is director of the program in intellectual property and technology law at the U of I College of Law, and is also heard as a commentator on our series Legal Issues in the News, has been for quite a while now. Well, the Department of Defense has both defensive structures and offensive structures when it comes to cyber security. I'm not sure to what extent a private business can have offensive structures. What exactly are people thinking about in terms of what businesses should be allowed to do in order to protect themselves?
Currently, of course, the biggest hurdle in trying to give the private sector any kind of right to protect themselves is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Mm-hmm. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, basically, which is sort of part of, you know, this a very broad-ranging statute that says that if you're a computer that's engaged in interstate commerce, and so it's literally any computer that's connected to the internet, then any kind of unauthorized access is illegal. And it can be subject to civil penalties. It can be subject to criminal penalties and so on. So the CFAA is very broad, and it really is the biggest hurdle and doesn't allow the private sector to do some of these sorts of things like, hey, you know, let me take some measures. Let me engage in active defense. Let me try to protect myself. And so there is a desire to have perhaps a self-defense exception. You know, hey, perhaps, you know, we should have a self-defense exception to the CFAA. You know, certainly it's true that, you know, if you are the private sector, you know, you might want something like that because, hey, when I am, especially in a sort of zero-day vulnerability situation, I am under attack. I want to be able to do something to mitigate the damage that's happening to me. And I want to be – I don't want to wait for the government to tell me anything. I don't want – I just want right now. I need to do something. And you know, and so it jives with broad notions of self-defense in other areas of the law, except that the CFAA currently – doesn't allow that. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So the law that's designed to protect me and my computer from attack also protects the computer of the person who is attacking me.
Indeed.
So if theoretically I had some way to, if I knew who was attacking me, I could send a bolt of lightning back down the line and fry their computer, I would be liable for the destruction of their computer.
Indeed. And you know, and the fact that you're doing it after you're responding is currently that wouldn't be allowed. And now, there are some other legitimate concerns. I mean, this is sort of if I knew precisely where some things were coming from, then perhaps I might actually do it. So there is an attribution issue, you know, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's easy to think of this as sort of being very precise when you're dealing with one intruder into your house. But when you're dealing with network computers, how many other third parties who may be innocent, how many computers are you damaging, what other things are you doing, and who's going to be responsible for that? So is an issue. So when you have self-defense, partly you say, hey, you have a right to defend yourself. But then there has to be some sort of mechanism to compensate or decide what is going to happen to all these innocent third parties. Yeah. And that's one of the issues.
And certainly hackers are very adept at covering their tracks. So that the business of trying to – you might know that you're under attack, but determining who that individual is attacking you and where they are, that can be extremely difficult.
It can be extremely difficult. One of the interesting things is that we've actually – done a lot of work in this area, you know, in the last decade. Mm-hmm. There's been a tremendous amount of, you know, technological advancement, but also advancement of understanding human nature, human behavior, you know, keeping track of even the speed of keystrokes and so on as unique ways of, hey, we can tell what different groups do and how they behave and what are their patterns of attack and when do they like to do certain things and so on. So, in fact, there is a rich body of knowledge that is developing. And so there is at least reason to believe that we're getting better at doing this attribution thing. Mm-hmm. And after all, we're really not interested in sort of, you know, off the cuff, one or two intrusions or whatever. We're really interested in this advanced, persistent threats. That's what they're sort of often called, as, you know, APTs, and, you know, where you're dealing with a group that is determined to get at some information. Might be critical information, might be information that is economically very valuable, or it might be information that they're simply trying to disable and create havoc. Mm-hmm. So you know, but they're very persistent, they're very advanced in their techniques, and you know, and so that also provides an opportunity for the people who might be the subject of these attacks to learn more about them and their patterns.
Well, what sort of complications does it pose, the fact that, say, someone who is engaged in a cybercrime, their footprints, so to speak, may go through a number of different jurisdictions? How does that complicate the matter of trying to pursue and prosecute people if you're having overlapping law enforcement agencies, for example, that might indeed claim some jurisdiction?
Right. That is fundamentally a huge problem. You have various bodies of law in this area. And, you know, there's not been an attempt to really try and reconcile these things. And so you have the European Convention on Cybercrime that says a lot of these things are not allowed. Of course, there is broad understanding, at least that self-defense is still legitimate. And then you have other bodies like, you know, even the UN Charter on Human Rights that sort of, you know, has, you know, implications here. And so in fact, there is... a lot of international laws that are out there that are in tension with each other and need to be reconciled. And ultimately, at some point, you are talking about some kind of you know, global solution. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there are bilateral efforts that are taking place. So interestingly, even U.S. and China, for example, are engaged in bilateral efforts to try and combat cybercrime, to try and share information. And the U.S. government has been urging China to try and, hey, if we tell you about something that's emanating from your country, please help us. You know, let's come up with a system where we can provide a request, give you information, and you're going to tell us, you know, what's going on. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that has been successful, depending on your point of view, to varying degrees. You know, not all these requests have necessarily been responded to. But you know, if you can't quite get the perfect transnational global solution, you can at least work this out bilaterally. You know, and ultimately, the cross-border, cross-jurisdictional issue has got to be confronted with.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call. We have somebody here to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to bring up a few issues and let you all talk about it. I mean, I hear that most of your approach has been via law. Though you mentioned the State Department, you also there's also departments like the Department of Commerce dealing with export certain technologies, et cetera, from falling into the hands of potential enemies, such as China. Even though you talked about China as a partner in terms of this, and I'll sort of go from that. The fact is, large numbers of attacks on industry and technology seem to be coming from China, and that's often where the countermeasures have to be done, whether by private industries. You mentioned a few that actively, not just passively, actively try to deal with the attempted hacks and theft from China. But I also want to shift that a lot of this is really a matter of national security and potential terrorist activity, whether from China, Iran, other places, parts of the former Soviet Union, which are fairly well documented. And really, the approach is not a matter of law, but a matter of war, if I shift that. Instead of law, it's really war, or preventative war. And I think those areas are really where the crux of the issue is, because that's where the greatest danger is to all of us. So I'll get off and let you discuss this on the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you want to take that on?
Yeah, the caller makes a bunch of points. I, in fact, agree with the caller that what I'm suggesting here, in including in some of the work that I've published, is that, in fact, you do need to do that. We do need to think about counter-striking. And we do need to think about, you know, I suggest that we should think about mitigative counter-striking. And what I'm suggesting also is that the legal regimes have to be fixed so that it's actually seen as being correct, legal, and appropriate. So it's not so much law versus something else. It's rather understanding what the nature of the problem is and how we deal with it, and bringing the laws and regulations to empower people to actually deal with the threat. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, you know, I very much see an important role for developing the technologies, for actually delineating what kind of regimes should be considered proper and appropriate, and then actually fixing our legal regimes to sort of be in sync with that.
Well, I was also kind of thinking when you were talking about the fact that there is this effort at bilateral cooperation involving the United States government and the Chinese government. That's a little ironic, since that does seem to be that's where a major threat comes from. That they're very organized cyber threats coming from China, and that in fact, we are told that its government, as a part of its defense policy, is exploring cyber warfare.
That's sort of one of those situations where you're not sure. You know, depending on which study you see, there's 12 groups to 20 groups that have been identified that these attacks are coming from. And the question then is, how many of them are in fact working with and for the government, and how many are not? But that shouldn't be stopping us from sort of, telling them, let's talk. We'll tell you what we're seeing, and there's probably something to be gained by continuing to talk, even though you realize that that is in fact the source of a lot of cyber threats.
Well, there it seems that when you're talking about cybersecurity or talking about cyber threats, you might break this down into two broad categories. And I think that really what we're talking about when we talk about cyber threats is, as the caller suggested, we're talking about cyber terrorism or cyber warfare.
Right.
So we're talking about a hostile government or a non-governmental entity whose interest is attacking and doing damage.
Right.
So these are the people that you'd say, they want to sabotage your utilities. They want to, if somebody could somehow figure out how to bring the banking system of the country crashing down, the economy would fall. Then there also is a smaller group that you might label cyber criminals, that they're just interested in trying to find a way to make some money. And there may be some overlap to the nature of the threat, may in fact be some overlap in how you respond. But how different are those two categories, say the cyber terrorist and the cyber criminal?
I think they are different, and they're different in sort of two important ways. One is scale, the other is purpose. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with someone where, by definition, when you're talking about cyber warfare, cyber terrorism, you're talking about massive chaos. You're talking about, we really don't care, just want to inflict a lot of harm. And wider the better, quicker the better, so on and so forth. The sort of the traditional sort of cyber criminal, cyber theft of information that has some economic value, some engineering designs, engineering drawings of whatever, whether it's the Boeing 787 Dreamliner or whatever else, and there you're really talking about something that is targeted. The scale is not wide, but in fact, there is a specifically, there's a goal, there's a mission that, I want to get this kind of information. And obviously the responses are different. One, in the first case, at least legally, there is a lot of rules and case law and statutes, part of the U.S. code, that in fact give the government broad powers to do lots of things. So for example, the Communications Act has a section where the president can take over all sorts of communication facilities in the case of sort of some sort of imminent state of war, etc. So wire communication facilities can be taken over and so on and so forth. And that's existed for a long time. And the presidential and the executive branch authority to deal with these sorts of situations is well understood. The real question is, if someone doesn't quite do this, knowing fully well that, when you do that, then you might get the whole wrath of a whole lot of sophisticated people on you and so on. And, I might be able to sort of achieve the same things by targeting a few little critical bricks and take those critical bricks off and do these things surgically and attack key nodal points in our economy and create just as much problem. And so I think that's where a lot of the CISPA efforts and so on are directed at. Hey, there's a few good choke points for these people. And so we really need to sort of figure out how we can do that. And much of that is not the DoD computers, or it's not something else. It's in the private hands. Yeah. And so, you know, we have to deal with that kind of threat as well. And indeed, even though it's targeted, even though it's a particular company or a particular set of industry sector, the effect could just be as large as a mass cyber war.
6-7 minutes left. Just I want to mention once more, our guest is Jay Kazin. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. He directs the program in intellectual property and technology law in the College of Law. We're talking about cybersecurity. Someone wants to call in real quick. We can get him in. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. Just for a moment to come back to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. This has now been around, I think, since what, the early 80s?
Yeah.
So it's been around for a long time. But and one of the things
it's actually been amended 9 times, you know, since then.
Well, and there are some people who think that it should be further amended. Here the question is, are the penalties severe enough? And you've made the argument, and I think, you know, it's a good argument that says that, well, penalties are all well and good. You would be better off deterring, but you, in a sense, you have to do both. So it is the thinking that really that somehow that the penalties for hacking, for cybercrime, aren't as strong as they should be?
Well, I mean, it's not so much that there is anything wrong with increasing the penalties. The question really is why are you increasing the penalties? To achieve some deterrence. But are these people actually deterred? Because are they actually worried that they're going to get caught and be prosecuted in the United States? I mean, so I think that's the real issue. Having said that, the CFAA actually has a fairly low threshold for criminal violations and felonies. All it requires is something like $5,000 of damage, you know, and that's on the effect side. And on the purpose side, if you're dealing with things like financial information, et cetera, you know, you don't even have those limitations. So in fact, I mean, the threshold for felony violations, criminal violations under the CFAA are actually quite low. Mm. The concern here is that a lot of these laws, you know, the Stored Communications Act, the CFAA, all of these are 30 years old, and they really need to get updated. You know, on the other hand, the kind of updating that has been done under the CFAA has actually, even though Congress has done this as recently as 2008, and that's, of course, you know, long after Internet and everything else, mm-hmm. It has been to expand what the definition of a protected computer. So now a protected computer, one that if you see any kind of unauthorized access would be considered a violation, is virtually any computer that's connected to the Internet. So this goes back to what we talked about before, which is that, hey, you know, now we're in a situation where we're not dealing with sort of, let's develop a set of norms and regulation that all of us can live with, and let's agree that we shouldn't be getting into each other's computers. You know, that sort of works well when you're dealing with someone who's willing to sign on to that sort of regime. And clearly, what we've experienced in the last decade with cybersecurity is that these people are not willing to sign on to these things. And so why should we be binding ourselves with really a regulation that is at this point creating more trouble for us?
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes left. Oh, we do have a caller, so we'll try to squeeze him in. A Piatone, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Real quick, I'll throw this out at you. Security problems with Facebook, YouTube, branch out LinkedIn. I know it's not so much with LinkedIn, but I think the government needs to step in a little bit more. And because I've been getting viruses on a regular basis now, hanged on to things that you think, you know, and it's kind of difficult. But the security issues, I know that Facebook is going IPO tomorrow, but there's got to be something a little bit more stringent. And I'm the last guy on the face of the planet that wants more restrictions. But cyber age, we got to do something. It just, there's too many ways to hack somebody's info. Thanks. I'll get
yeah.
Them.
All right.
Bye.
Well, that's and you know that's it's we are cautioned all the time that as individuals in all of our various devices, if they're internet enabled, we go on the internet, we're circulating personal information. We're always told, well, you've got to be responsible for your security. But having said that, is there a role of for government here or further involvement in all of our personal devices?
Well, I think there are good arguments on both sides on this issue. On one hand, as the caller pointed out, perhaps at minimum, the government needs to set some security standards. And we don't have to tell you what to do and what technology to employ, but we can at least tell you what we think ought to be some of the standards of compliance. Mm-hmm. And here are the security standards, and you at least got to meet some of them. On the other hand, the argument is, hey, you know, this area, you build one fence and the other guys find a way of taking this fence down and you have to build the next fence. And this is just this sort of, that's the way this game is played. And so, you know, the government is always going to be in responsive mode. And you know, the government telling the private sector, Facebook, whoever else, what to do, you know, that's going to be a couple of generations behind all the time. And so, in fact, you know, these companies have every incentive just simply to try to cater to customers like the caller who are concerned about security violations. And they have every incentive to try to be updated. And they spend a lot of money and effort to do this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can see why it's important for the government to step in. But it's not entirely clear that the government is always going to be at the forefront and be able to sort of really keep up with the kind of threats that are out there.
Yeah, it's something that's only going to get more and more of an issue as more people have more and more internet-enabled devices in their pockets. People move towards cloud storage of their sensitive data. As they do live more and more of their life online, it's simply going to be a bigger and bigger problem.
Well, it is, especially as you mentioned, with as you move more to the cloud and as more and more of your important information is remote from you. Mm-hmm. And it's not in your hard drive, it's not in your laptop anymore. And then you have this, going back to something else we said, a lot of these cloud service providers have servers in different countries in different places. And so it's not even clear that your data is being stored within the boundaries of the United States.
Well, for the moment, we'll leave it there. I'm sure we'll be back to these issues on other shows. Our guest, Jay Kaysen, he's professor of law at the University of Illinois, where he is also director of the program in intellectual property and technology law at the U of I College of Law. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It was a terrific conversation.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, proud to be a part of Champaign-Urbana and our surrounding communities for more than 80 years. Starting from a single Champaign location, Christie now serves patients from 14 clinic locations. More about Christie Clinic in your community is at ChristieClinic.com. Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning. I'm Sean Powers. Here are the latest numbers in the commodity markets. September Kansas City winter wheat trading at 904, up 23.5. December 922, up 24. September Chicago wheat trading 902.25, up 23.5. December 913.75, up 25.5. September corn 795.75, up 5.75. December 789.25, up 11. March 781.75, up 10.25. August soybeans trading at $16.89, up 39¾. September $16.35½, up 40. November $16.11, up 41½. August soybean meal $5.28.60, up $18.60. September $5.07.10, up $14.80. August soybean oil $52.16, up 58¢. September $52.35, up 58¢. August live cattle $118.47½, down 32½¢. October $123.75, down 25¢. August feeder cattle $136.25, down $1.42.